Parshas Mishpatim. So the Rav said the following on Ve'elim HaMishpatim. Following the giving of the Aseres HaDibros, the Ten Commandments, the Torah should have preceded immediately with Perek Chaf Dalet, in which God tells Moshe to seal the covenant with the people. And this would be followed by the construction of the Mishkan in Parshas Truma and Tetzaveh, which was a required step toward the fulfillment of the divine promise of what Vilakachti, when you take the people out of Egypt, you will worship God on this mountain, encompassing both the revelation at Mount Sinai and the construction of the Mishkan. Finally, there is a return to the story of the revelation with the episode of the golden calf. But Parshas Mishpatim, that represents a dramatic departure from these themes. Instead of continuing with the revelation, there's an interruption. Parshas Mishpatim, which its many detailed laws of Nezikin, of torts and damages, it seems to depart from the context. Apparently, Parshas Mishpatim is an interpretation of the Aseres HaDibros. Without having Parshas Mishpatim, there can be no Mamleches Kohanim V'Goy Kadosh, a kingdom of educators and role models and a unique holy nation. Almost all the fundamental principles of the mitzvos may be found here in Parshas Mishpatim. Parshas Mishpatim lays out a framework for civil law. Why should the Torah address the question of financial commitments? Why should the Torah care about the situation of a paid or unpaid watchman? Parshas Mishpatim discusses issues of kinyanim, of acquisitions, of chazakos, of presumptions of ownership, and shtar, and of the transfer of promissory notes. These monetary issues would seem to be out of place in a moral code. The conclusion, then, is that civil laws carry religious significance. Destruction of property and trespassing are not merely violations of civil law, but they are moral transgressions. If one studies the law of the Avodah on Yom Kippur or the laws of Shofar on Rosh Hashanah, there is a fulfillment of studying in Yana Diyoma, the topics that relate to the day. But the study of Perek Cheskes Habatim, dealing with, you know, the presumption of ownership of a home or real estate, or Shnayim Ochsim Betalis, you know, the situation of who owns a garment, on these holidays, it is no less exalting. Even though such study may not constitute in Yana Diyoma, the topic of the day, it fulfills the mitzvah of Torah study. Parshas Mishpatim was introduced at this particular point in the Torah to demonstrate that these civil laws are in fact religious laws. The last Mishnah in Bava Basra states that if one wishes to become a scholar, he should study Nezikin. The study of these topics, it sharpens the mind, and it allows for the development of precision and depth. The study of Nezikin inspires the one who studies, helping him develop his intuition and intellect. There's a special capacity which the Almighty implanted in Hilchos Nezikin that inspires at both the emotional and the intellectual level. The best svarim of the Rishonim and Achronim, they were always in the area of Nezikin. The next section, when it talks about ayin tachas ayin, which is always translated incorrectly as an eye for an eye. Although the written law contains the prescription of an eye for an eye, the oral law interprets this statement to signify monetary compensation alone. Why is the wording in the written law so misleading? Because there is, in fact, no true restitution for causing the loss of an eye. Maiming diminishes the injured party's tzelem Elokim, the victim's divine image. The spiritual personality is irreparably affected. For man's organs do not merely perform organic functions. They drive fundamentally human responses. For example, when a person gazes upon a tree, he sees not only the tree, but he also apprehends its beauty. On a strictly moral plane, then, the offender indeed deserves retribution in kind for imparting such incalculable pain and suffering. But on a practical level, however, no court is allowed to exact such a penalty. It says, V'chi yigof shor ish eshor re'ehu. The laws of property damage, right? If you have an animal and it attacks your peer, your fellow's animal. Dr. Martin Heidegger one of the most important philosophers of the 20th century. He taught ethics and spirituality at the University of Berlin in the early part of the 20th century. Yet, when Hitler rose to power, he and a large coterie of his peers, they were among the first to embrace Nazism. The study of ethics alone cannot mold the ethical personality. The study of Torah, on the other hand, it does accomplish this. Gedolei Yisrael represents spirituality, refinement in conduct, sensitivity, sympathy, compassion. Yet their primary focus is upon what is known as lumdus, a formal and abstract discipline in the study of Torah. Strangely, study of the rules of the ox that gores, or the egg that is laid on Yom Tov, somehow enhances the human ethical personality, elevating both the mind and the heart. How does such study affect morality? There is only one answer. Torah is min hashamayim. It is the word of God. Torah ennobles one's character, redeeming a person from frivolity, from vulgarity and cruelty. It elevates the person, providing meaning to his life. It says in the pasuk, "Im b'machteres yimatzei haganav, v'huka umeis ein lo damim." You had this person that, in a subterranean way, broke into one's home. The homeowner, trying to defend his assets, is allowed, in the event that the ganav, that the thief, the criminal who broke in, is going to try to hurt him, the homeowner, instead of just letting him take the assets, can kill the thief to protect his life. Instead of just parting and leaving, he can kill the thief to protect himself in the homeowner's defense of his property. The majesty and the dignity of a human being, it expresses itself in the fact that man has inalienable rights. He has the moral right not only to self-defense, but as well to defend his possessions and to fight for them. If a burglar enters one's home, there will be no danger to the homeowner if the owner does not interfere with a burglary. Yet, the Torah gives the homeowner the right to kill the burglar on the assumption that the burglar will kill the homeowner if confronted by him. One may defend his property even if that act of defense results in the act of killing. The covenantal community is not a community of the meek. It is not a community that describes to turning the other cheek. Covenantal man is called upon to defend himself and affirm his rights. Yet at the same time, the covenantal community displays the trait of sacrificial action. There are times a covenantal man is summoned to lead a selfless life. Abraham is the exemplar of this duality. On the one hand, he is portrayed as someone who has accumulated wealth. On the other hand, he is ready to give up his only son. Selfhood and selflessness, dignity and sacrificial life are characteristic of the covenantal community. The Rav said something incredibly, incredibly beautiful. I'll derech drush, but it's just very powerful. The pasuk says, "Ki yitein ish areyo kesef o kelim lishmor." Right? You hand over something to your fellow to protect, to watch. If a man gives his neighbor money or articles for safekeeping, Judaism asserts that man is the property of God, as we say in the Slichos, "Haneshama lach vaguf palach." The soul is yours and the body is yours. All of man's talents, all of man's endowments and qualities, our very personality are owned by God. Man's activities must therefore be in conformity with the will of God. Man's body and soul are governed by the general rule articulated with respect to deposits of personal property with another for safekeeping. All of one's activities must therefore conform with the directives of the depositor, meaning Hashem is giving us a neshama. Hashem is giving us a body as a deposit. We don't own it. It's not ours. It belongs to God. And therefore, we have the responsibilities of Shmira to watch it, to safeguard it. Accordingly, on Yom Kippur, man finds himself in a situation analogous to that described in the next verse. V'nikrav bal habayis el ha'elohim im lo shalach yado bim leches re'ehu. that the Balabais comes to the judges. I'm sorry, that the Balabais has to say before the judges, I didn't, so to speak, violate that the property of the home of the owner. I didn't violate their possessions. Man must convince God that he has not misappropriated the deposit. In the concluding Ne'ilah prayer of Yom Kippur, we use the phrase, Leman nechdal me'oshek yadenu. Yom Kippur was bestowed upon us so that we cease from misappropriating our very selves. Appropriately, any sin committed by man, it constitutes larceny. It is theft from God. Listen to this. This is incredible. The Rav said, Rabbi Meir and his wife Bruria were proud parents of beautiful twin boys who died of an extended illness over one Shabbos. Throughout the Shabbos, Bruria did not inform Rabbi Meir of the tragedy so as not to mar his Shabbos joy. However, when the day waned, it was Bruria's task to convey the terrible news to her husband. After Havdalah, Bruria related the following parable to Rabbi Meir in the form of a halachic question. She said, Some time ago, a certain man came and he left two diamonds in my trust as a pikadon. Now he has called for them. Shall I return them to him or not? Only after Rabbi Meir replied in the affirmative did Bruria reveal to him the awful news. And that's the Medrash of Mishlei, Perek Lamed Aleph, Parsha Lamed Aleph. As moving as his story is, the halachic question posed by Bruria seems trivial. Was there any doubt that the owner of the diamonds had the right to take them back? The answer is so obvious that her question seems superfluous. Why would Bruria ask her husband for a ruling in such a simple case of Jewish law? One must interpret this parable by interpolating some additional detail into her analogy. And this is really what she asked. A mysterious stranger, his face hidden behind a dark cloak, he knocks at Bruria's door. As she opens the door, the stranger silently thrusts a small box into her hands and vanishes into the night. The puzzled Bruria opens the box and is startled to find two beautiful diamonds. She wonders, did the stranger intend to place the diamonds in her trust as a shmirah for safekeeping? Or perhaps they were a matana, an outright gift? Bruria resolves to wait a few weeks to see if the stranger returns to claim his package. She meticulously takes care of the diamonds in accordance with all the applicable halachas, all the laws of the pikadon, as she waits for the stranger to return. Weeks, months, years pass, and the stranger has not reappeared. Bruria thinks to herself that maybe the stranger is no longer alive, or perhaps he indeed meant to give her the diamonds as an outright gift. On a fateful Shabbos years later, Bruria is startled again to hear a knock on the door. Hurriedly darning her robe, Bruria answers the door. The mysterious stranger with the hidden face is back. He grabs the diamonds from her hands, and once again he quickly and silently disappears. This is the story of Bruria told Rabbi Meir. Unlike a normal pikadon, where an item is held in safekeeping for a specific period of time, as prescribed by the owner of that object, the period of safekeeping for God's pikadon, it is open-ended. God is the hidden stranger who thrusts upon man all sorts of items of value, money, honor, health, wisdom, children. God's face is obscured and he says nothing. We often make Bruria's mistake. We begin to think of God's pikadon as a gift. Only later, and often under tragic circumstances, are we forced to confront the fact that God does not give us these items outright. They are only entrusted to us for safekeeping. If we guard them properly, God may allow us to keep them longer. If, on the other hand, we do not acknowledge God as the owner of the pikadon, he may come and claim them sooner. It says, V'ger lo sona, you cannot mistreat the stranger, v'lo tilchatzenu, nor oppress them verbally. Because you were strangers in the land of Egypt. In general, the Torah ethic is derived from experience. We have mercy on all uprooted and defenseless human beings in exile. We are burdened with an ethical norm to help because we remember ourselves how we felt when we were in distress. This casts a light upon our mysterious historical destiny. Our nation was born in the crucible of exile, bondage, and suffering. We emerged as a people from the sand dunes of the Sinai Desert, where we wandered 40 years. Why could we not rise as a people in our own land in prosperity and abundance? The answer is simple. If our morality had to be done of kindness and chesed, it could not have been formulated for people who knew not what suffering is. Only people in exile could understand and appreciate a morality of kindness. Therefore, Gullus was a central experience in the life of our patriarchs, and it is still a major experience in our lives. Two more very powerful pieces. It talks about, you know, oppressing the widow and the orphan. Im ane ta ane oso. Right? If you oppress, let me quote it. Kol almana v'yasom lo sanu. You cannot oppress any widow or orphan. Im ane sa ane oso. If you double language, ane sa aneim, the orphan. Ki im tsaoki tsak elai. If he will cry out to me, shamoa eshma tsak aso. I will hear his cry. Notice, everything is a double verb. V'charapi v'harakti eschem becharev. In the Midas Adin will come, and I will kill you by the sword. V'ayu nishechem almanos uvnechem yisomim. Your wives will become widows, and your children orphans. What type of an oppression does the Bible prohibit? Is it murder, mutilation, causing of severe pain, destruction of property? Not only these, but lesser evils as well. Whatever affects the peace of mind of the widow or the orphan is considered oppression. A word, a gesture, a facial expression by which the widow or the orphan feels hurt, in short, whatever causes an accelerated heartbeat, that comes under oppression. The following is recorded in Masechet Smachos, Ches Dalet. When Rabbi Shimon ben Gamliel and Rabbi Yishmael appeared before the Romans and were condemned to death, Rabbi Shimon wept and Rabbi Yishmael said, "You are but two steps from the bosom of the righteous. Why are you weeping?" Rabbi Shimon ben Gamliel answered, "I weep because we are being executed as if we were murderers." To which Rabbi Yishmael answered, "Perhaps you were at the table or asleep and a woman came to inquire about her ritual purity. The attendant said to her, 'Look, the great rabbi is asleep.' For the Torah said, 'If you torment the widow,' and continued, 'Then I shall kill you by the sword.'" What was wrong with Rabbi Shimon's conduct? He had come home exhausted after a full day's work, and he lay down for a short rest. It was a busy day. The entire load of communal responsibilities pressed heavily upon his frail shoulders. Cruel Rome continued its ruthless policy of religious persecution and economic ruin of the Jewish people. Rabbi Shimon ben Gamliel had to perform an almost impossible task: to negotiate with, as well as defy, the conquerors, to communicate with his Jewish brethren, telling them not to despair, and at the same time ready them for rebellion and the supreme sacrifice. While he was dozing, a woman entered with an inquiry: "Is she ritually pure or impure?" The attendant, knowing how fatigued Rabbi Shimon was, he advised her to wait until he awoke. He did not wish to disturb Rabbi Shimon. How then did Rabbi Shimon afflict the woman? That's the question. What kind of affliction was that? The woman was a poor widow. She was extremely sensitive. While waiting for Rabbi Shimon, the thought went through her head: had my rich neighbor come with a similar question, the attendant would have acted differently. He would have aroused Rabbi Shimon. "It's because of my poverty and loneliness," she thought. "He didn't mind making me wait." She sighed and she brushed away a tear. So Rabbi Shimon did afflict a widow, and thus violated the Torah prohibition. Her tear was responsible for the tragic death of Rabbi Shimon. It says in the Mechilta of Rabbi Yishmael, whether it's a great oppression or a small oppression, they're all the same. The degree of hurt is irrelevant. Causing transient humiliation and causing severe physical pain, they're both assumed under affliction, afflicting the widow and orphan. The Ibn Ezra comments on the transition from the plural, lo ta'anun, right, the plural, you in the plural should not. Then it goes to the singular, im ane ta'ane, and then it goes back to the plural, v'harakti eschem, you in the plural. The use of the plural form of the verb suggests that both the oppressor as well as the passive observer will be considered equally guilty of the same transgression. Ta'anun. Who's the plural? The oppressor and the observer. And each is to be punished through the same death penalty. V'haragti eschem. There are no other instances in the Torah where the onlooker receives the same punishment as the instigator. For example, if one observes a Jew who desecrates the Shabbos and does not object, he may not have fulfilled his obligation to rebuke a fellow Jew, but he is certainly not guilty of having violated the Shabbos. The Torah here warns that we must have no tolerance for cruelty, and that the observer who does not protest is considered as culpable as the perpetrator himself. The prohibition of lo ta'anun is similar to the prohibition of watching passively as a fellow Jew is being killed. Neither the nature nor the magnitude of the oppression mitigates the punishment. Inoy muat, inoy meruba, signified by the dual form of ane ta'ane. Even though Rabbi Shimon's act of inoy would appear trivial, if the widow was hurt through Rabbi Shimon's delay, the offense was punishable. Nevertheless, if she was hurt through it, it's punishable. When one actively persecutes a widow or an orphan, he inflicts a great deal of psychological harm. In other instances, the oppression is much more subtle and requires a sensitivity to the hurt one may be inflicting. For this reason, the Torah uses a grammatical form involving verb repetition, the double verb, throughout this section, indicating that one is culpable for both forms of oppression, ane to ane, whether the oppression is meruba, greater, or muat, lesser. Shamoa eshma, God listens in both cases to the widow or orphan who cries out in pain, and sa'uk yitzak, in reaction to either situation. And then the final selection from the Rav is es ha'ani imach. You have to take care of the poor that is with you. You have to take care of the poor that is with you. But it's interesting. It describes it, he'ani imach. You should be one with the poor. Based upon this phrase, Rashi comments that one should look upon himself as the poor person. The fact that you are the giver and the poor person is the receiver is nothing more than a capricious act of fate. The roles could easily be reversed. This idea can be illustrated through the following story. One day, Rabbi Eliyachayim Meizelz of Ludge, he was a great Misnagdisha Talmud Chacham. He was the chief rabbi of Ludge. You know, Ludge was a huge city. It was at the famous textile center of Central Europe. And many, many Jews lived there. It was primarily Alexander and Gera Hasidim. And because neither wanted to have the upper hand, so they agreed that the chief rabbi would neither be a Ger nor a Alexander. They would always take a Misnagd. And this Rabbi Eliyachayim Meizelz was an incredible Talmud Chacham. And again, there were a number of huge industrialists, very successful Jewish industrialists in Ludge. Probably the greatest of them all, and if you go to the cemetery in Ludge, you see this, and if you go to the property of the family where his factory and where the home were, you'll see this, was Poznansky, the Poznansky family. So get back to the story. One winter day, Rabbi Eliyachayim Meizelz of Ludge, he went to visit the home of the great manufacturer by the name of Poznansky. The butler answered the door. Reb Chaim entered the vestibule of the home and he requested that Mr. Poznansky meet him in the vestibule. The butler responded that Mr. Poznansky would like to greet the chief rabbi in his study, but Reb Chaim insisted that Poznansky meet him in the vestibule. Mr. Poznansky came to meet Reb Chaim and they engaged in conversation for close to a half an hour. As the vestibule was not heated, Mr. Poznansky was shivering from the cold. He asked Reb Chaim once again, can you please, let's enter the home where I could treat you properly. It's warm. We can continue talking there. Reb Chaim responded that he had come to collect money for a number of destitute people in town who could not even afford firewood. He therefore insisted that Mr. Poznansky greet him in the vestibule so that Mr. Poznansky himself would experience the cold of winter. Then the Rav said, historically, we Jews have fared poorly when subjected to the trial of wealth. When a Jew acquires excessive wealth, unfortunately, we become animal-like. While the nations of the world divert a portion of their wealth towards spiritual matters, towards culture, towards higher ideals, under similar circumstances, the Jew takes on the trappings of a vulgar, cynical materialism. Vayishman Yeshurun Vayivat. And the Jewish people became fat, became wealthy, and we kicked back. Unfortunately, all too often, that is the characteristic reaction of the Jew to wealth. For some unknown reason, a Jew cannot combine mital hashamayim u'mishmanei aretz, the dew of the heavens, with the fat of the earth. Having one, he cannot have the other. On the other hand, when the Jew is confronted with the trial of poverty or suffering, the Jewish people have fared very, very well. A Jew does not spill blood when he is hungry. When he is hungry, he senses the hunger of his fellow. When he is cold, he feels his brother's discomfort. Es ha'ani imach.